Jundo and Gil wandered the streets of Niigata, held by that thread, pretending they weren't about to abduct her from the nearby artist's village. A line kept ringing in Jundo's mind about how in the middle of the water, the lovers decide to row no further. They walk the city in a trance, waiting for dark. Advertisements especially had an effect on Jundo. There were no ads in North Korea, and here they were on buses and posters, across video screens, immediate and imploring, couples clasping one another, a sad child. He asked Gil what each one said, but the answers pertained to car insurance and telephone rates. Through a window, they watched Korean women cut the toenails of Japanese women. For fun, they operated a vending machine and received a bag of orange food neither would taste. Gil paused before a store that sold equipment for undersea exploration. In the window was a large bag made to stow dive gear. It was black and nylon, and the salesperson showed them how it would hold everything needed for an underwater adventure for two. They bought it. They asked a man pushing a cart if they could borrow it, and he told them at the supermarket they could get their own. Inside the store, it was almost impossible to tell what most of the boxes and packages contained. The important stuff, like radish bushels and buckets of chestnuts, were nowhere to be seen. Gil purchased a roll of heavy tape, and from a section of toys for children, a little watercolor set in a tin. Gil at least had someone to buy a souvenir for. Darkness fell. Storefronts lit suddenly with red and blue neon, and the willows were eerily illuminated from below. Car headlights flashed in his eyes. Jundo felt exposed, singled out. Where was the curfew? Why didn't the Japanese respect the dark like normal people? They stood outside a bar, time yet to kill. Inside, people were laughing and talking. Gil pulled out their yen.
No sense taking any back, he said.
Inside, he ordered whiskeys. Two women were at the bar as well, and Gil bought their drinks. They smiled and returned to their conversation.
Did you see their teeth? Gil asked.
So white and perfect, like children's teeth.
When Jundo didn't agree, Gil said,
Relax, yeah? Loosen up.
Easy for you, Jundo said. You don't have to overpower someone tonight. Then get her across town. And if we don't find Officer Saw on that beach...
Like that would be the worst thing, Gil said. You don't see anyone around here plotting to escape to North Korea. You don't see them coming to pluck people off our beaches.
That kind of talk doesn't help.
Come, drink up, Gil said. I'll get the singer into the bag tonight. You're not the only guy capable of beating a woman, you know? How hard can it be?
I'll handle the singer, Jundo said. You just keep it together.
I can stuff a singer in a bag, okay? Gil said. I can push a shopping cart. You just drink up. You're probably never going to see Japan again.
Gil tried to speak to the Japanese women, but they smiled and ignored him. Then he bought a drink for the bartender. She came over and talked with him while she poured it. She was thin-shouldered, but her shirt was tight and her hair was absolutely black. They drank together, and he said something to make her laugh. When she went to fill an order, Gil turned to Jundo.
If you slept with one of these girls, Gil said, you'd know it was because she wanted to, not like some military comfort girl trying to get 9 stamps a day in her quota book, or a factory gal getting married off by her housing council. Back home, pretty girls never even raise their eyes to you. You can't even have a cup of tea without her father arranging a marriage.
Pretty girls? Jundo thought. The world thinks I'm an orphan. That's my curse, Jundo told him. But how did a Pyongyang boy like you end up doing such shitty jobs? Gil ordered more drinks, even though Jundo had barely touched his.
Going to that orphanage really messed with your head, Gil said. Just because I don't blow my nose in my hand anymore,
doesn't mean I'm not a country boy from Myosan.
You should move on too.
In Japan, you can be anyone you want to be.
They heard a motorcycle pull up, and outside the window they saw a man back it in line with a couple of other bikes. When he took the key from the ignition, he hid it under the lip of the gas tank. Gil and Jundo glanced at one another. Gil sipped his whiskey, swishing it around, then tipping his head to delicately gargle.
You don't drink like a country boy.
You don't drink like an orphan.
I'm not an orphan.
Well, that's good, Gil said. Because all the orphans in my landmine unit knew how to do was take. Your cigarettes? Your socks? Your soju.
Don't you hate it when someone takes your soju?
In my unit, they gobbled up everything around them, like a dog digests his pups, and for thanks, they left you the puny nuggets of their shit.
Jundo gave the smile that puts people at ease in the moment before you strike them. Gil went on.
But you're a decent guy.
You're loyal like the guy in the martyr story.
You don't need to tell yourself that your father was this and your mother was that. You can be anyone you want. Reinvent yourself for a night. Forget about that drunk and the nail hole in the wall.
Jundo stood. He took a step back to get the right distance for a turnbuckle kick. He closed his eyes. He could feel the space. He could visualize the hip pivoting, the leg rising, the whip of the instep as it torqued around. Jundo had dealt with this his whole life, the ways it was impossible for people from normal families to conceive of a man in so much hurt that he couldn't acknowledge his own son, that there was nothing worse than a mother leaving her children, though it happened all the time. That take was a word people used for those who had so little to give as to be immeasurable. When Jundo opened his eyes, Gil suddenly realized what was about to happen. He fumbled his drink.
Whoa, he said. My mistake, okay? I'm from a big family. I don't know anything about orphans. We should go. We've got things to do.
Okay, then, Jundo said. Let's see how you treat those pretty ladies in Pyongyang.
Behind the auditorium was the artist's village, a series of cottages ringing a central hot spring. They could see the stream of water, still steaming hot, running from the bathhouse. Mineral white, it tumbled down bald, bleached rocks toward the sea. They hid the cart, then Jundo boosted Gil over the fence. When Gil came around to open the metal gate for Jundo, Gil paused a moment and the two regarded one another through the bars before Gil lifted the latch and let Jundo in. Tiny cones of light illuminated the flagstone path to Rumina's bungalow. Above them, the dark green and white of magnolia blocked the stars. In the air was conifer and cedar, something of the ocean. Jundo tore two strips of duct tape and hung them from Gil's sleeves.
That way, Jundo whispered. They'll be ready to go.
Gil's eyes were thrilled and disbelieving.
So, we're just going to storm in there?
He asked.
I'll get the door open, Jundo said.
Then you get that tape on her mouth.
Jundo pried a large flagstone from the path and carried it to the door. He placed it against the knob, and when he threw his hip into it, the door popped. Gil ran toward a woman, sitting up in bed, illuminated only by a television. Jundo watched from the doorway as Gil got the tape across her mouth, but then in the sheets and the softness of the bed, the tide seemed to turn. He lost a clump of hair. Then she got his collar, which she used to off-balance him. Finally, he found her neck, and they went to the floor, where he worked his weight onto her, the pain making her feet curl. Jundo stared long at those toes. The nails had been painted bright red. At first, Jundo had been thinking, grab her here, pressure her there. But then a sick feeling rose in him. As the two rolled, Jundo could see that she had wet herself.
and the rawness of it, the brutality of what was happening was newly clear to him. Gil was bringing her into submission, taping her wrists and ankles, and she was kneeling now, him laying out the bag and unzipping it. When he spread the opening for her, her eyes, wide and wet, failed, and her posture went woozy. Jundo pulled off his glasses, and things were better with the blur. Outside, he breathed deeply. He could hear Gil struggling to fold her up so she would fit in the bag. The stars over the ocean, fuzzy now, made him remember how free he'd felt on that first night crossing of the Sea of Japan, how at home he was on a fishing vessel. Back inside, he saw Gil had zipped the bag so that only Rumina's face showed, her nostrils flaring for oxygen. Gil stood over her, exhausted but smiling. He pressed the fabric of his pants against his groin so she could see the outline of his erection. When her eyes went wide, he pulled the zipper shut. Quickly, they went through her possessions. Gil pocketed yen and a necklace of red and white stones. Jundo didn't know what to grab. On a table were medicine bottles, cosmetics, a stack of family photos. When his eyes landed on the graphite dress, he pulled it from its hanger.
"What the fuck are you doing?" Gil asked.
"I don't know," Jundo told him. The cart, overburdened, made loud clacking sounds at every crease in the sidewalk. They didn't speak. Gil was scratched and his shirt was torn. It looked like he was wearing makeup that had smeared. A clear yellow fluid had risen through the scab where his hair was missing. When the cement sloped at the curbs, the wheels had a tendency to spin funny and spill the cart, the load dumping to the pavement. Bundles of cardboard lined the streets. Dishwashers hosed down kitchen mats in the gutters. A bright, empty bus whooshed past. Near the park, a man walked a large white dog that stopped and eyed them. The bag would squirm a while, then go still. At a corner, Gil told Jundo to turn left, and there, down a steep hill and across a parking lot, was the beach.
"I'm going to watch our backs," Gil said.
The cart wanted free. Jundo doubled his grip on the handle. "Okay," he answered. From behind, Gil said,
"I was out of line back there with that orphan talk. I don't know what it's like to have parents who are dead or who gave up. I was wrong. I see that now."
"No harm done," Jundo said. "I'm not an orphan." From behind, Gil said,
"So tell me about the last time you saw your father."
The cart kept trying to break loose. Each time Jundo had to lean back and skid his feet. "Well, there wasn't a going-away party or anything." The cart lurched forward and dragged Jundo a couple of meters before he got his traction back. "I'd been there longer than anyone. I was never getting adopted. My father wasn't going to let anyone take his only son. Anyway, he came to me that night. We'd burned our bunks, so I was on the floor.
Gil, help me here."
Suddenly, the cart was racing. Jundo tumbled as it came free of his grip and barreled downhill alone.
"Gil!"
he yelled, watching it go. The cart got speed wobbles as it crossed the parking lot, and striking the far curb, the cart hopped high into the air, pitching the black bag out into the dark sand. He turned, but Gil was nowhere to be seen. Jundo ran out onto the sand, passing the bag in the odd way it had settled. Down at the waterline, he scanned the waves for Officer Saw, but there was nothing. He checked his pockets. He had no map, no watch, no light. Hands on knees, he couldn't catch his breath. Past him, billowing down the beach, came the graphite dress, filling and emptying in the wind, tumbling along the sand until it was taken by the night. He found the bag, rolled it over. He unzipped it some, heat pouring out. He pulled the tape from her face, which was abraded with nylon burns. She spoke to him in Japanese. "I don't understand," he said. In Korean, she said,
"Thank God you rescued me."
He studied her face, how raw and puffy it was.
"Some psychopath stuck me in here," she said. Thank God you came along. I thought I was dead, and then you came to set me free.
Jun-do looked again for any sign of Gil, but he knew there wouldn't be.
Thanks for getting me out of here, she said. Really, thanks for setting me free.
Jun-do tested the strip of tape with his fingers, but it had lost much of its stickiness. A lock of her hair was fixed to the tape. He let it go in the wind.
My God,
she said.
You're one of them.
Sand blew into the bag, into her eyes.
Believe me, he said. I know what you're going through. You don't have to be a bad guy, she said. There's goodness in you. I can see it. Let me go, and I'll sing for you. You won't believe how I can sing.
Your song has been troubling me, he said. The one about the boy who chooses to quit rowing in the middle of the lake.
That was only an aria, she said. From a whole opera, one filled with subplots and reversals and betrayals.
Jun-do leaned close now. Does the boy stop because he has rescued the girl, and on the far shore he will have to give her to his superiors? Or has the boy stolen the girl, and therefore knows that punishment awaits?
It's a love story, she said.
I understand that, he said. But what is the answer? Could it be that he knows he's marked for a labor camp? She searched his face as if he knew the answer. How does it end? He asked. What happens to them?
Let me out and I'll tell you, she said. Open this bag and I'll sing you the ending.
Jun-do took the zipper and closed it. He spoke to the black nylon where her face had been. Keep your eyes open, he said. I know there's nothing to see, but whatever happens, don't shut them. Darkness and close quarters, they're not your enemy. He dragged the bag to the waterline. The ocean, frothy cold, washed over his shoes as he scanned the waves for Officer Saw. When a wave reached high upon the sand and licked the bag, she screamed inside and he had never heard such a shriek. From far up the beach, a light flashed at him. Officer Saw had heard her. He brought the black inflatable around, and Jun-do dragged the bag into the surf. Using the straps, the two of them rolled it into the boat.
Where's Gil?
He asked.
Gil's gone, Jun-do said.
He was right beside me, and then he wasn't. They were knee-deep in waves, steadying the boat. The lights of the city were reflected in Officer Saw's eyes.
You know what happened to the other mission officers? He asked. There were four of us. Now there's only me. The others are in Prison 9. Have you heard of that place, Tunnel Man? The whole prison's underground. It's a mine. And when you go in, you never see the sun again. Look, scaring me isn't going to change anything. I don't know where he is.
Officer Saw went on.
There's an iron gate at the mine head. And once you pass that, that's it. There are no guards inside, no doctors, no cafeteria, no toilets. You just dig in the dark. And when you get some ore, you drag it to the surface to trade through the bars for food and candles and pickaxes. Even the bodies don't come out. He could be anywhere,
Jun-do said.
He speaks Japanese.
From the bag came Rumina's voice.
I can help you,
she said.
I know Niigata like the lines on my palm. Let me out, and I swear I'll find him.
They ignored her.
Who is this guy? Jun-do asked. The spoiled kid of some minister, Officer Saw said. That's what they tell me. His dad sent him here to toughen him up. You know, the hero's son, always the meekest.
Jun-do turned and considered the lights of Niigata. Officer Saw put his hand on Jun-do's shoulder.
You're soldierly, he said. When it comes time to dispense, you dispense.
He removed the bag's nylon shoulder strap and made a slip loop at one end.
Gil's got a noose around our fucking necks. Now it's his turn.
Jundo walked the warehouse district with a strange calm. The moon, such as it was, reflected the same in every puddle, and when a bus stopped for him, the driver took one look and asked for no fare. The bus was empty except for two old Korean men in back. They still wore their white paper short-order hats. Jundo spoke to them, but they shook their heads. Jundo needed the motorcycle to stand a chance of finding Gil in this city. But if Gil had any brain at all, he and the bike were long gone. When Jundo finally rounded the corner to the whiskey bar, the black motorcycle gleamed at the curb. He threw his leg over the seat, touched the handlebars. But when he felt under the lip of the tank, there was no key. He turned to the bar's front windows. And there through the glass was Gil, laughing with the bartender. Jundo took a seat beside Gil, who was intent on a watercolor in progress. He had the paint set open, and he dipped the brush in a shot glass of water tinctured purple-green. It was a landscape, with bamboo patches and paths cutting through a field of stones. Gil looked up at Jundo, then wet his brush, swirling it in yellow to highlight the bamboo stalks. Jundo said to him, "You're so fucking stupid."
"You're the stupid one," Gil said. "You got the singer. Who would come back for me?"
"I would," Jundo told him. "Let's have the key." The motorcycle key was sitting on the bar, and Gil slid it to him. Gil twirled his finger in the air to signal another round. The bartender came over. She was wearing Romina's necklace. Gil spoke to her, then peeled off half the yen and gave it to Jundo.
"I told her, this round's on you," Gil said.
The bartender poured three glasses of whiskey, then said something that made Gil laugh. Jundo asked, "What did she say?"
"She said you look very strong, but too bad you're a pussy man."
Jundo looked at Gil. Gil shrugged.
"I maybe told her that you and I got in a fight over a girl. I said that I was winning until you pulled out my hair."
Jundo said, "You can still get out of this. We won't say anything, I swear. We'll just go back, and it'll be like you never ran."
"Does it look like I'm running?"
Gil asked.
"Besides, I can't leave my girlfriend."
Gil handed her the watercolor, and she tacked it on the wall to dry, next to another one of her, looking radiant in the red and white necklace. Squinting from a distance, Jundo suddenly understood that Gil had painted not a landscape, but a lush, pastoral landmine map.
"So you were in the minefields," he said.
"My mother sent me to the Mansudae to study painting," Gil said. "But father decided the minefields would make a man of me, so he pulled some strings."
Gil had to laugh at the idea of pulling a string to get posted on a suicide detail.
"I found a way to make the maps rather than do the mapping."
As he spoke, he worked quickly on another watercolor, a woman, mouth wide, lit from below so her eye sockets were darkened. Right away it had the likeness of Romina, though you couldn't tell whether she was singing with great intensity or screaming for her life. "Tell her you'll have one last drink," Jundo said, and passed her all the yen.
"I'm really sorry about all this," Gil said. "I really am. But I'm not going anywhere. Consider the opera singer a gift, and send my regrets."
"Was it your father who wanted the singer? Is that why we're here?" Gil ignored him. He started painting a portrait of him and Jundo together, each giving the thumbs-up sign. They wore garish, forced smiles, and Jundo didn't want him to finish.
"Let's go," Jundo said. "You don't want to be late for karaoke night at the Yanggakdo or whatever you elites do for fun."
Gil didn't move. He was emphasizing Jundo's muscles, making them oversized, like an ape's.
"It's true," Gil said. "I've tasted beef and ostrich. I've seen Titanic, and I've been on the internet 10 different times. And yeah, there's karaoke. Every week there's an empty table where a family used to sit, but now they're gone. No mention of them.
and the songs they used to sing are missing from the machine.
I promise you, Jundo said. Come back, and no one will ever know.
The question isn't whether or not I'll come with you, Gil said. It's why you're not coming with me.
If Jundo wanted to defect, he could have done it a dozen times. At the end of a tunnel, it was as easy as climbing the ladder and triggering a spring-loaded door.
In this whole stupid country, Jundo said, the only thing that made sense to me were the Korean ladies on their knees cleaning the feet of the Japanese. I could take you to the South Korean embassy tomorrow. It's just a train ride. In 6 weeks, you'd be in Seoul. You'd be very useful to them, a real prize.
Your mother, your father, Jundo said. They'll get sent to the camps.
Whether you're a good karaoke singer or bad, eventually your number comes up. It's only a matter of time.
What about Officer Saul? Will some fancy whiskey make you forget him digging in the dark of Prison 9?
He's the reason to leave, Gil said. So you don't become him.
Well, he sends his regards, Jundo said, and dropped the loop of nylon over Gil's head, pulling the slack so the strap was snug around his neck. Gil downed his whiskey.
I'm just a person, he said. I'm just a nobody who wants out.
The bartender saw the leash. Covering her mouth, she said,
"Homojanai."
I guess I don't need to translate that, Gil said.
Jundo gave the leash a tug and they both stood. Gil closed his watercolor tin, then bowed to the bartender.
"주선진니 주 살랄레루야,"
he said to her. With her phone, she took a picture of the two of them, then poured herself a drink. She lifted it in Gil's honor before drinking.
"Fucking Japanese,"
Gil said.
"You've got to love them. I said I was being kidnapped to North Korea, and look at her."
"Take a good long look," Jundo said, and lifted the motorcycle key from the bar. Past the shore break, they motored into swells sharpened by the wind. The black inflatable lifted, then dropped flat in the troughs. Everyone held the lifeline to steady themselves. Rumina sat in the nose, fresh tape around her hands. Officer Saw had draped his jacket around her. Except for that, her body was bare and blue with cold. Jundo and Gil sat on opposite sides of the raft, but Gil wouldn't look at him. When they reached open water, Officer Saw backed off the engine enough that Jundo could be heard.
"I gave Gil my word," he told Officer Saw. "I said we'd forget how he tried to run."
Rumina sat with the wind at her back, hair turbulent in her face.
"Put him in the bag," she said.
Officer Saw had a grand laugh at that.
"The opera lady's right," he said. "You caught a defector, my boy. He had a fucking gun to our heads, but he couldn't outsmart us. Start thinking of your reward," he said. "Start savoring it."
The idea of a reward, of finding his mother and delivering her from her fate in Pyongyang, now made him sick. In the tunnels, they would sometimes wander into a curtain of gas. You couldn't detect it. A headache would spike, and you'd see the darkness throb red. He felt that now with Rumina glaring at him. He suddenly wondered if she didn't mean him, that Jundo should go in the bag. But he wasn't the one who beat her or folded her up. It wasn't his father who'd ordered her kidnapping. And what choice did he have about anything? He couldn't help that he was from a town lacking in electricity and heat and fuel, where the factories were frozen in rust, where able-bodied men were either in labor camps or were listless with hunger. It wasn't his fault that all the boys in his care were numb with abandonment and hopeless at the prospect of being recruited as prison guards or conscripted into suicide squads. The lead was still around Gil's neck. Out of pure joy, Officer Saw leaned over and yanked it hard, just to feel it cinch.
"I'd roll you over the side," he said, "but I'd miss what they're going to do to you."
Gil winced from the pain.
"Jundo knows how to do it now," he said. "He'll replace you
and they'll send you to a camp so you never talk about this business.
You don't know anything, Officer Saw said. You're soft and weak. I fucking invented this game. I kidnapped Kim Jong-il's personal sushi chef. I plucked the dear leader's own doctor out of an Osaka hospital, in broad daylight, with these hands.
You don't know how Pyongyang works, Gil said. Once the other ministers see her, they'll all want their own opera singers.
A cold white spray slapped them. It made Rumina inhale sharply, as if every little thing was trying to take her life. She turned to Jun-do, glaring again. She was about to say something, he could tell. A word was forming on her lips. He unfolded his glasses, put them on. Now he could see the bruising on her throat, the way her hands were fat and purple below the tape on her wrists. He saw a wedding ring, a birth surgery scar. She wouldn't stop glaring at him. Her eyes. They could see the decisions he'd made. They could tell it was Jun-do who picked which orphans ate first and which were left with watery spoonfuls. They recognized that it was he who assigned the bunks next to the stove and the ones in the hall where Blackfinger lurked. He'd picked the boys who got blinded by the arc furnace. He'd chosen the boys who were at the chemical plant when it made the sky go yellow. He'd sent Hashin, the boy who wouldn't speak, who wouldn't say no, to clean the vats at the paint factory. It was Jun-do who put the gaff in Bo-sung's hands. What choice did I have? Jun-do asked her. He really needed to know, just as he had to know what happened to the boy and the girl at the end of the aria. She raised her foot and showed Jun-do her toenails, the red paint vibrant against the platinum dark. She spoke a word, then drove her foot into his face. The blood, it was dark. It trickled down his shirt, last worn by the man they'd plucked from the beach. Her big toenail had cut along his gums, but it was okay. He felt better. He knew the word now, the word that had been upon her lips. He didn't need to speak Japanese to understand the word, die. It was the ending to the opera, too. He was sure of it. That's what happened to the boy and the girl on the boat. It wasn't a sad story, really. It was one of love. The boy and the girl, at least, knew each other's fates, and they'd never be alone. There were many kidnappings to come, years of them, in fact. There was the old woman they came upon in a tidal pool on Nishino Island. Her pants were rolled up and she peered into a camera mounted on three wooden legs. Her hair was gray and wild, and she went without protest in exchange for Jun-do's portrait. There was the Japanese climatologist they discovered on an iceberg in the Sugaru Strait. They plucked his scientific equipment and red kayak, too. There was a rice farmer, a jetty engineer, and a woman who said she'd come to the beach to drown herself. Then the kidnappings ended, as suddenly as they'd begun. Jun-do was assigned to language school to spend a year learning English. He asked the control officer in Gyeongsong if the new post was a reward for stopping a minister's son from defecting. The officer took Jun-do's old military uniform, his liquor ration card, and coupon book for prostitutes. When the officer saw the book was nearly full, he smiled.
Sure, he said.
Ma Jun-ni in the Onjin Mountains was colder than Chongjin had ever been. Jun-do was grateful for the blue headphones he wore all day, as they drowned out the endless tank exercises of the 9th Mechanized, which was stationed there. The school officials had no interest in teaching Jun-do to speak English. He simply had to transcribe it, learning vocabulary and grammar over the headphones, and key by clacking key, parroting it back on his manual typewriter.
I would like to purchase a puppy,
the woman's voice would say over the headphones, and this Jun-do would tap out. At least near the end, the school got a human teacher, a rather sad man, prone to depression, that Pyongyang had acquired from Africa. The man spoke no Korean, and he spent the classes asking the students grand, unanswerable questions, which greatly increased their command of the interrogative mode.
For 4 seasons, Jundo managed to avoid poisonous snakes, self-criticism sessions, and tetanus, which struck soldiers nearly every week. It would start innocently enough. A barbed wire puncture, a cut from the rim of a ration tin. But soon came fevers, tremors, and finally a coiling of the musculature that left the body too twisted and rigid for a casket. Jundo's reward for these achievements was a listening post in the East Sea, aboard the fishing vessel Junma. His quarters were down in the Junma's aft hold, a steel room big enough for a table, a chair, a typewriter, and a stack of receivers that had been pilfered from downed American planes in the war. The hold was lit only by the green glow of the listening equipment, which was reflected in the sheen of fish water that seeped under the bulkheads and constantly slicked the floor. Even after 3 months aboard the ship, Jundo couldn't stop visualizing what was on the other side of those metal walls. Chambers of tightly packed fish sucking their last breath in the refrigerated dark. They'd been in international waters for several days now, their North Korean flag lowered so as not to invite trouble. First, they chased deep-running mackerel, and then schools of jittery bonito that surfaced in brief patches of sun. Now they were after sharks. All night, the Junma had long-lined for them at the edge of the trench, and at daybreak, Jundo could hear above him the grinding of the winch and the slapping of sharks as they cleared the water and struck the hull. From sunset to sunrise, Jundo monitored the usual transmissions. Fishing captains mostly. The ferry from Uichi to Vladivostok. Even the nightly check-in of 2 American women rowing around the world. One rowed all night, the other all day, ruining the crew's theory that they'd made their way to the East Sea for the purpose of having girl sex. Hidden inside the Junma's rigging and booms was a strong array antenna, and above the helm was a directional antenna that could turn 360 degrees. The U.S. and Japan and South Korea all encrypted their military transmissions, which sounded only like squeals and bleats. But how much squeal and where and when seemed really important to Pyongyang. As long as he documented that, he could listen to whatever he liked. It was clear that the crew didn't like having him aboard. He had an orphan's name, and all night he clacked away on his typewriter down there in the dark. It was as if having a person aboard whose job it was to perceive and record threats made the crew, young men from the port of Kinje, sniff the air for danger as well. And then there was the captain. He had reason to be wary, and each time Jundo made him change course to track down an unusual signal, it was all he could do to contain his anger at the ill luck of having a listening officer posted to his fishing ship. Only when Jundo started relating to the crew the updates of the 2 American girls rowing around the world did they begin to warm to him. When Jundo had filled out his daily requisition of military soundings, he roamed the spectrum. The lepers sent out broadcasts, as did the blind, and the families of inmates imprisoned in Manila, who broadcast news into the prisons. All day the families would line up to speak of report cards, baby teeth, and new job prospects. There was Dr. Rendezvous, a Brit who broadcast his erotic dreams every day, along with the coordinates of where his sailboat would be anchored next. There was a station in Okinawa that broadcast portraits of families that U.S. servicemen refused to claim. Once a day, the Chinese broadcast prisoner confessions, and it didn't matter that the confessions were forced, false, and in a language he didn't understand. Jundo could barely make it through them. And then came that girl who rode in the dark. Each night she paused to relay her coordinates, how her body was performing, and the atmospheric conditions. Often she noted things. The outlines of birds migrating at night. A whale shark seining for krill off her bow. She had, she said, a growing ability to dream while she rode. What was it about English speakers that allowed them to talk into transmitters as if the sky were a diary? If Koreans spoke this way, maybe they'd make more sense to Jundo. Maybe he'd understand why some people accepted their fates while others didn't. He might know why people sometimes scoured all the orphanages looking for one particular child
when any child would do, when there were perfectly good children everywhere. He'd know why all the fishermen on the Junma had their wives' portraits tattooed on their chests, while he was a man who wore headphones in the dark of a fish hold on a boat that was 27 days at sea a month. Not that he envied those who rowed in the daylight. The light, the sky, the water, they were all things you looked through during the day. At night, they were things you looked into. You looked into the stars. You looked into dark rollers and the surprising platinum flash of their caps. No one ever stared at the tip of a cigarette in the daylight hours, and with the sun in the sky, who would ever post a watch? At night on the Junma, there was acuity, quietude, pause. There was a look in the crew members' eyes that was both far away and inward. Presumably, there was another English linguist out there, on a similar fishing boat, pointlessly listening to broadcasts from sunrise to sunset. It was certainly another lowly transcriber like himself. He'd heard that the language school where they taught you to speak English was in Pyongyang and was filled with yangbans, kids of the elite who were in the military as a prerequisite to the party and then a life as a diplomat. Jundo could just imagine their patriotic names and fancy Chinese clothes as they spent their days in the capital practicing dialogues about ordering coffee and buying overseas medicines. Above, another shark flopped onto the deck, and Jundo decided to call it a night. As he was turning off his instruments, he heard the ghost broadcast. Once a week or so, an English transmission came through that was powerful and brief, just a couple of minutes before it was gone. Tonight, the speakers had American and Russian accents, and as usual, the broadcast was from the middle of a conversation. The two spoke about a trajectory, and a docking maneuver, and fuel. Last week, there'd been a Japanese speaker with them. Jundo manned the crank that slowly turned the directional antenna, but no matter where he aimed it, the signal strength was the same, which was impossible. How could a signal come from everywhere? Just like that, the broadcast seemed to end. But Jundo grabbed his UHF receiver and a handheld parabolic and headed above decks. The ship was an old Soviet steel-hulled vessel made for cold water, and its sharp, tall bow made it plunge deep into waves and leap the troughs. He held the rail and pointed the dish into the morning haze, sweeping the horizon. He picked up some chatter from container vessel pilots, and toward Japan, he got all the craft advisories cross-cut with a VHF Christian broadcast. There was blood on the deck, and Jundo's military boots left drunk-looking tracks all the way to the stern, where the only transmissions were the squawks and barks of U.S. naval encryption. He did a quick sweep of the sky, dialing in a Taiwan Air pilot who lamented the approach of DPRK airspace. But there was nothing. The signal was gone.
"Anything I should know about?" the captain asked.
"Steady as she goes," Jundo told the captain.
The captain nodded toward the directional antenna atop the helm, which was made to look like a loudspeaker.
"That one's a little more subtle," he said.
There was an agreement that Jundo wouldn't do anything foolish, like bringing spying equipment on deck. The captain was older. He'd been a heavy man, but he'd done some time aboard a Russian penal vessel, and that had leaned him so that now his skin hung loose. You could tell he'd once been an intense captain, giving clear-eyed commands, even if they were to fish in waters contested by Russia. And you could tell he'd been an intense prisoner, laboring carefully and without complaint under intense scrutiny. And now, it seemed, he was both. The captain lit a cigarette, offered one to Jundo, then returned to tallying sharks, using a hand counter to click off each one the machinist winched aboard. The sharks had been hanging from lead lines in open water, so they were in a low-oxygen stupor when they breached the water and slammed against the hull before being boomed up. On deck, they moved slowly, nosing around like blind puppies,
their mouths opening and closing as if there were something they were trying to say. The job of the second mate, because he was young and new to the ship, was to retrieve the hooks, while the first mate, in 7 quick cuts, dorsal to anal, took the fins and then rolled the shark back into the water, where, unable to maneuver, it could race nowhere but down, disappearing into the blackness, leaving only a thin contrail of blood behind. Jundo leaned over the side and watched one descend, following it down with his parabolic. The water crossing the shark's gills would revive its mind and perceptions. They were above the trench now, almost 4 kilometers deep, perhaps a half hour of free fall, and through his headphones, the background hiss of the abyss sounded more like the creeping, spooky crackle of pressure death. There was nothing to hear down there. All the subs communicated with ultra-low frequency bursts. Still, he pointed his parabolic toward the waves and slowly panned from bow to stern. The ghost broadcast had to come from somewhere. How could it seem to come from every direction if it didn't come from below? He could feel the eyes of the crew.
"You find something down there?"
the machinist asked.
"Actually," Jundo said, "I lost something."
Come first light, Jundo slept, while the crew, pilot, machinist, first mate, second mate, and captain alike, spent the day crating the shark fins in layers of salt and ice. The Chinese paid in hard currency, and they were very particular about their fins. Jundo woke before dinner, which was breakfast time for him. He had reports to type before darkness fell. There had been a fire on the Junma which took the galley, the head, and half of the bunks, leaving only the tin plates, a black mirror, and a toilet that had cracked in two from the heat. But the stove still worked, and it was summer, so everyone sat on the hatches to eat, where it was possible for the men to view a rare sunset. On the horizon was a carrier group from the American fleet, ships so large they didn't look as if they could move, let alone float. It looked like an island chain, so fixed and ancient, as to have its own people and language and gods. On the long line, they'd caught a grouper, whose cheeks they ate raw on the spot, and a turtle, unusual to hook. The turtle would take a day to stew, but the fish they baked whole and pulled off the bone with their fingers. A squid had also snagged on the line, but the captain wouldn't abide them on board. He had lectured them many times on the squid. He considered the octopus the most intelligent animal in the ocean, the squid the most savage. They took off their shirts and smoked, even as the sun fell. The Junma was pilotless, cantering in the waves, buoys rolling loose on the deck, and even the cables and booms glowed orange in the oven-colored light. The life of a fisherman was good. There were no endless factory quotas to fill, and on a ship there was no loudspeaker blaring government reports all day. There was food. And even though they were leery about having a listening officer on board, it meant that the Junma got all the fuel coupons it needed, and if Jundo directed the ship in a way that lowered the catch, everyone got extra ration cards.
"So, third mate," the pilot said, "how are our girls?"
That's what they call Jundo sometimes, the third mate, as a joke. "They're nearing Hokkaido," Jundo told them. "At least they were last night. They're rowing 30 kilometers a day."
"Are they still naked?" the machinist asked.
"Only the girl who rows in the dark," said Jundo.
"To row around the world," the second mate said. "Only a sexy woman would do that. It's so pointless and arrogant. Only sexy Americans would think the world was something to defeat."
The second mate couldn't have been more than 20. On his chest, the tattoo of his wife was new, and it was clear she was a beauty.
"Who said they were sexy?"
Jundo asked, though he pictured them that way too.
"I know this," the second mate said. "A sexy girl thinks she can do anything. Trust me. I deal with it every day."
"If your wife is so hot," the machinist asked, "how come they didn't sweep her up to be a hostess in Pyongyang?"
It's easy,
the second mate said.
Her father didn't want her ending up as a barmaid or a whore in Pyongyang. So he pulled some strings and got her assigned to the fish factory. A beautiful girl like that, and along comes me.
I'll believe it when I see it, the first mate said. There's a reason she doesn't come to see you off.
Give it time, the second mate said. She's still coping.
I'll show her the light.
Hokkaido,
the pilot said.
The ice up there is worse in the summer. The shelves break up, currents chum it. It's the ice you don't see. That's what gets you.
The captain spoke. Shirtless, you could see all his Russian tattoos. They looked heavy in the sideways light, as if they were what had pulled his skin loose.
The winter's up there, he said. Everything freezes. The piss in your prick and the fish gore in your beard. You try to set a knife down and you can't let go of it. Once, we were on the cutting floor when the ship hit a growler. It shook the whole boat, knocked us down into the guts. From the floor, we watched that ice roll down the side of the ship, knuckling big dents in the hull.
Jundo looked at the captain's chest. The tattoo of his wife was blurred and faded to a watercolor. When the captain's ship didn't return one day, his wife had been given a replacement husband, and now the captain was alone. Plus, they'd added the years he was in prison to his service debt to the state, so there'd be no retirement now.
The cold can squeeze a ship, the captain suddenly said. Contract the whole thing, the metal door frames, the locks, trapping you down in the waste tanks, and nobody, nobody's coming with buckets of hot water to get you out.
The captain didn't throw a look or anything, but Jundo wondered if the prison talk was aimed at him, for bringing his listening equipment on deck, for raising the specter that it could all happen again. When darkness fell, and the others went below, Jundo offered the second mate 3 packs of cigarettes to climb atop the helm and shinny the pole upon which the loudspeaker was mounted.
I'll do it, the second mate said. But instead of cigarettes, I want to listen to the rowers.
The boy was always asking Jundo what cities like Seoul and Tokyo were like, and he wouldn't believe that Jundo had never been to Pyongyang. The kid wasn't a fast climber, but he was curious about how the radios worked, and that was half of it. Jundo had him practice pulling the cotter pin so that the directional antenna could be lifted and pointed toward the water. Afterward, they sat on the winch house, which was still warm and smoked. The wind was loud in their ears. It made their cigarettes flare. There wasn't another light on the water, and the horizon line separated the absolute black of the water from the milk dark of the star-choked sky. A couple of satellites traversed above, and to the north, tracers of shooting stars.
Those girls in the boat, the second mate said. You think they're married?
I don't know, Jundo said. What's it matter?
What's it take to row around the world? A couple years? Even if they don't have husbands, what about everyone else? The people they left behind? Don't those girls give a shit about anybody?
Jundo picked some tobacco off his tongue and looked at the boy, who had his hands behind his head as he squinted at the stars. It was a good question. What about the people left behind? But an odd one for the second mate to ask.
Earlier tonight, Jundo said, you were all for sexy rowers. They do something to piss you off?
I'm just wondering what got into them to just take off and paddle around the world.
Wouldn't you if you could?
That's my point. You can't. Who could pull it off? All those waves and ice in that tiny boat? Someone should have stopped them. Someone should have taken that stupid idea out of their heads.
The kid sounded new to whatever heavy thinking was going on in his brain. Jundo decided to talk him down a bit. They already made it halfway, he pointed out. Plus, they have to be some pretty serious athletes. They're trained for this. It's probably what they love. And when you say boat,
You can't be thinking of this bucket. Those are American girls. Their craft is high-tech, with comforts and electronics. You can't be picturing them like party officials' wives rowing a tin can around. The second mate wasn't quite listening.
And what if you do make it around the world? How do you wait in line for your dormitory toilet again, knowing that you've been to America? Maybe the millet tasted better in some other country, and the loudspeakers weren't so tinny. Suddenly, it's your tap water that smells not so good. Then what do you do?
Jundo didn't answer him. The moon was coming up. Above, they could see a jet rising out of Japan. Slowly, it began its great veer away from North Korean airspace. After a while, the second mate said,
"The sharks will probably get them."
He flicked his cigarette away.
"So, what's this all about? Pointing the antenna and all. What's down there?"
Jundo wasn't sure how to answer.
A voice.
"In the ocean? What is it? What's it say?"
There are American voices and an English-speaking Russian. Once a Japanese guy. They talk about docking and maneuvering, stuff like that.
"No offense, but that sounds like the conspiracy talk the old widows are always trading in my housing block."
It did sound a little paranoid when the second mate said it out loud, but the truth was the idea of conspiracy appealed to Jundo. That people were in communication, that things had a design, that there was intention, significance, and purpose in what people did. He needed to believe this. Normal people, he understood, had no need for such thinking. The girl who rode during the day had the horizon of where she came from, and when she turned to look, the horizon of where she was headed. But the girl who rode in the dark had only the splash and pull of each stroke, and the belief that they'd all add up to get her home. Jundo looked at his watch. "It's about time for the night rower to broadcast," he said. "Or maybe it's the daytime girl you want." The second mate suddenly bristled.
"What kind of a question is that? What's it matter which one? I don't want either of them. My wife is the most beautiful woman in her housing block. When I look into her eyes, I know exactly what she's thinking. I know what she's going to say before she says it. That's the definition of love. Ask any old-timer."
The second mate smoked another cigarette and then tossed it in the sea.
"Say the Russians and Americans are at the bottom of the ocean. What makes you think they're up to no good?"
Jundo was thinking about all the popular definitions of love. That it was a pair of bare hands clasping an ember to keep it alive. That it was a pearl that shines forever. Even in the belly of the eel that eats the oyster, that love was a bear that feeds you honey from its claws. Jundo visualized those girls, alternating in labor and solitude, that moment when the oarlocks were handed off. Jundo pointed to the water. "The Americans and Russians are down there, and they're up to something, I know it. You ever hear of someone launching a submarine in the name of peace and fucking brotherhood?" The second mate leaned back on the winch house, the sky vast above them.
"No," he said. "I suppose not."
The captain came out of the pilot house and told the second mate he had shit buckets to clean. Jundo offered the captain a smoke, but when the boy had gone below, the captain refused it.
"Don't put ideas in his head," he said,
and walked deliberately across the dark gangway to the high-riding bow of the Junma. A large vessel was creeping by, its deck carpeted with new cars. As it passed, likely headed from South Korea to California, the moonlight flashed in rapid succession off 1,000 new windshields. A couple of nights later, the Junma's holds were full, and she was headed west, for home. Jundo was smoking with the captain and the pilot when they saw the red light flash on and off in the pilot house. The wind was from the north, pacing them, so the deck was calm, making it seem like they were standing still. The light flashed on and off again.
"You going to get that?"
the pilot asked the captain.